Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a founder, you know, it's going to be quite an exciting conversation. We're going to be talking about all about having an impact, you know, with the company, thinking about reinventing constantly the technology, also thinking about the, you know, staffing, how to go about that, you know, how to navigate the different cycles, especially what happened, you know, to them, you know, during COVID, as well as productizing, you know, how to think about productizing when you're thinking or you're starting more in a way that perhaps, you know, is not the scalable way, but it gets you into different paths. And lastly, we're going to be talking about funding, you know, fundraising and some of the events that they, you know, run across, especially with bad actors that put them in a tough situation, you know, negotiating, you know, terms, you know, already after having signed a term sheet and more, you know, when they were in diligence. But again, you know, building, scaling, financing and all of that good stuff. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Greg Mulohan. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Alejandro. It's a pleasure to be here.
So originally born in Kentucky, but you moved quite a little bit, you know, with the family. So how was life growing up?
I had a great life growing up. I came from a pretty technical family. My dad ran chemical plants, making vegetable oil, of all things, for a good chunk of his career. And my mom was an industrial engineer who turned into a technology teacher. And so I was surrounded by this understanding of heavy industry, but also understanding, you know, kind of what the next generation technology looks like very early on, and came to love both of those things, which is what led me to the chemicals industry over many, many years.
And I mean, computers too. You know, I'm sure that having your mother there, you know, was a big influence.
It was. You know, from her, I learned a great level of curiosity around digital technology. And that led me to I went to North Carolina State for undergrad and studied computer engineering, and really found myself in a position where I was excited about computer architecture. I wanted to learn how to design processors, and actually did learn how to design processors. But my big challenge there was I didn't love it. I really wanted to be down more in the fundamental science. And so I moved into transistor theory, moved into transistor design, and then realized that was just a material science problem. So started in the materials industry and actually went and got a graduate degree in materials. And so it was a lucky combination, being able to learn physics and chemistry, but also with that computer science and computer engineering grounding that allowed me to do what I do today.
And how do you find yourself in Cambridge all of a sudden?
Yeah, so I was lucky. I was studying at North Carolina State and was about to graduate, and I had applied for the Gates Cambridge Scholarship. That's a story for another day, but had gotten pretty far along in the process and had an opportunity to meet a professor at Cambridge that I was really excited about working with. Didn't end up winning the scholarship, but was at that point really emotionally committed to being there. And so because I had the opportunity to go, I took it. And really, it was an unbelievable academic community. But it also was a group of people that was similarly curious. It was a really special place to be to learn material science and to think about how data analytics could play a role in that space. And believing at the time, I mean, now it's sort of common sense, but at the time that materials informatics or using data in materials was going to be a very important technology.
So then ultimately, you know, you come back to the U.S., And essentially, you went into a semiconductor company. So why did you choose that path?
Yeah, you know, I believed at the time, and still do to a great degree, that the sustainable future of the planet and frankly, our ability to support, you know, a growing population of middle class required electricity and electricity efficiently delivered. That was really kind of what was very important to me. And so I did my master's and was working on solar cells, and then I came back and worked in power electronics. And so specifically, I was looking at, you know, how do we make more efficient power devices, like, you know, the power bricks on your computer. You notice they've gotten smaller. That's the material I was making, was the material that enables the power brick on your computer to get smaller, but also is notably more efficient, wastes less power. And so it was a passion for me. It was this idea that we could make a change in the world. And it was a huge technology challenge, but that made it all the more fun. You know, it's not, we're not doing easy things. We want to do hard things because they're interesting.
So why, you know, pausing the professional career and going back to studying?
Yeah, you know, at that time, I was at this relatively small company. They were in the 20s and 30s while I was there. I became the senior most person without an MBA or a PhD. So the writing was on the wall for me that I'd kind of probably hit the end of my time there. And I also realized, you know, I wanted to learn the business side of things. I learned the technology, but I hadn't fully understood what it meant to take a technology to market. And so I applied to a few different programs, but ended up at Stanford for my MBA. And, you know, it was being an engineer. Going into an MBA program is a super interesting thing because, you know, there are engineers there, but it's certainly not the majority. And so learning business culture, learning business language, you know, the math skills were never a problem, but a lot of the other stuff I had never seen before. And so I was able to open my mind. I was also able to meet a really important colleague. I met a guy who was actually, even before we started, his name is Dr. Bryce Meredig. He had finished his PhD in machine learning for material science. And then was at Stanford to get his MBA. And we had this immediate connection. You know, I was kind of the guy with the industrial problem, and he was the guy with the academic solution. And we sort of figured that if we could push the problem and the solution together and make them meet in the middle, that we could have something really special. And so the summer between our 2 years of business school, this is in 2013, we actually built a machine learning system. And we worked with a group at University of California, Santa Barbara. They had a bunch of data about a certain class of materials known as thermoelectrics. And we were able to use these machine learning approaches to invent an entirely new class of thermoelectrics. And it worked. It worked experimentally. And so at that point, first of all, nobody publishes science papers out of business school. That was kind of fun. But we also knew that we had a technology here that was really revolutionary and could bring a lot of new thinking to an industry that was really able to benefit from new thinking.
So then what happened next?
So we because we were in the Stanford ecosystem, we were relatively quickly able to raise money. We had a couple professors that we'd worked with closely who knew us and knew our business and knew what we were trying to do. And so we raised an initial note of about $1 million. At the time, that felt like a lot, though in the history of the company, certainly only a starting point. But it gave us the space and time to further develop the company and develop the idea. And so in 2014, we went full time, then we graduated and started to hire our first few folks. And as we did that, we realized we needed to take this product into market in a pretty weird way. You know, we had sort of been surrounded by people doing the lean startup method or some, you know, related idea of we're going to take something to the market and get the market to tell us what we want. In our case, we were going into the materials and chemicals industry, which is not known for being particularly digital. It's not known for being particularly able to adopt new technologies, at least not of the digital variety. And so we had to basically, and we refused to call it this at the time, but basically formed a consulting firm. We had people that would deliver our software, that we would use the software on their behalf. And then we would help them invent new, sustainable, high-performance materials and chemicals. They'd own the IP, we'd own the software, but we still had to do a lot of the digital work. And for the next 5 years, that was our growing business. We were essentially a consultancy, which is not what any of us wanted to be, especially our investors. It's what the market needed at the time.
How do you go from the consulting, you know, aspect to all of a sudden productizing the operation and making it scalable?
Yeah, you know, it was really... We didn't really want to. I mean, it was always the vision, but there are lots of visions where you realize the pain to get to the vision is just so high that you don't even want to go there. And that's where we kind of had gotten to. We had realized that the consulting model worked. We knew we wanted to move to software, but we couldn't do it until we had several of our customers approach us and say, we cannot do business with you anymore. And the reason we can't do business with you anymore is that we are one of the largest companies on planet Earth, and you have 17 people on your team. And so you'll never service us. It's just physically impossible. Unless you have a scalable software platform, in which case we are interested. And so we heard this from a few different sort of mega companies. And we realized that it was both a more scalable model and one that we could execute on because the market had changed. Now these companies were starting to think at least a little bit digitally. Never perfectly, but a little bit.
So for the people that are listening to get it, what ended up being the business model of Citroën? How do you guys make money?
Yeah, so we're a little bit unique. The world of materials and chemicals informatics, often called materials informatics, using data science to invent new materials and refine them. There have been a lot of companies that have started and died over the years. Most of them have tried to use a royalty model where if you invent something using our platform, we get 2% of gross sales for several years or something. Citroën has never operated that way. And there's a lot of reasons for that, but we offer a SaaS platform that companies use to invent billion-dollar materials, and we just get software fees. That might seem crazy, but it's how we ensure that our customers are some of the happiest customers in the world. And then, of course, if they need help, we have a professional services team. But we are, at our core, the SAP or the Salesforce of the materials development process. Your data lives with us, you use our AI, and you invent your new thing.
So then, in this case, I mean, you were alluding to earlier, you know, on the capital raise. I mean, you guys have raised quite a bit of money. How much capital have you guys raised to date? And what has been the experience of going through the different cycles?
Yeah, we've raised just shy of $75 million in the history of the company. It's been super interesting. I mean, I'm sure all your listeners know that just as a venture community, we have gone through many different phases since 2014 and 2015. We've had moments where things looked like they were taking off. We were seeing companies get funded, you know, just with incredible, incredible volumes of cash. And then we've gone through periods where things have been tougher. I think we have sort of gotten lucky, and I say this only in hindsight, that when things were really, really hot, we raised pretty modestly. And it was partly because people didn't understand the industry and partly because I think the market is something that people take time to understand overall. But it also means that as things have softened a little bit in recent years, we've been able to continue to maintain our valuation and be in a position where, you know, we have a sustainable business on our hands. And that's maybe the most important thing to me is, you know, we've had venture capitalists push us, especially before they invest, push us to really go big and make a big investment. And it's either, you know, go big or go home. And that doesn't really work in the chemicals industry because you're going to end up going home. You have to be modest and be careful about what you do in an old line industry like chemistry. And so we've actually been very diligent about growing ourselves and not, frankly, running ourselves out of capital as we're learning the market, growing the market, and becoming the leader of the market.
Hey, guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So then I know that there was quite a bit of experiences there that were not as easy with investors. I know that there was one in particular where it was all the way to the wire with you know, bad actors there, you know, when it comes to agreeing to terms, renegotiating terms later on in diligence, putting you guys against the wall, you know, really when it comes to runway and options. So what happened there with you guys?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny because in general, I've had very positive experiences with investors, but I've worked with enough of them now that you're always going to have some tough ones. And we did have a case where an investor was offered us a term sheet, and it was very explicit about each of the key terms. As many of your listeners will know, these things aren't hard to read. And when we got the formal docs back, and I make it a point to read the docs myself, we get our counsel to do it too, but I'm always pretty careful. We noticed that some of the definitions had changed. And the definitions changed in such a way that they would have worked really against us. They would have dramatically decreased our valuation in a future state when this person or when this firm would have had an option to invest further in the company. And it actually probably would have ceded control into their hands. And it was difficult because this was in a period where the company was running low on cash. We needed to be particularly careful. And fortunately, our existing investors at the time were able to rally around and help us so we could step away from this relationship, because it was one where, you know, I think in hindsight, I should have and now do get to know investors better before I accept terms from them, because, you know, these are long-term relationships. They need to be built in trust. And I don't know what happened on their side. Maybe it was done all in good faith, but it had a very bad faith effect on me. And I want to make sure that I can always look someone in the eye and know that they are not going to try to pull anything intentionally or unintentionally. And I'm very lucky that my current investors are that way.
So how were you able to go back to the investors to be able to turn things around and not find yourself in a situation of catastrophe?
Yeah, I mean, you know, what I would say is to any founders that are listening, you know, investors are your best friends and your worst enemies a lot of times, right? You know, they're always pushing you to be bigger and better, but they're also extremely, you know, they have their own expectations and desires as well. In this particular case, I developed a very strong trust relationship with a couple of our largest investors, and I was able to go to them and be very transparent. It was not a time for me to play games on the back of other games. It was time for me to say, this is the situation we're in. This is what I fear will happen. And let's come to a plan together. And so that's what we did. And they were actually able to, they had reserves and they were able to put together a small and modest, but reasonable round for us that was able to bridge us to the next phase of the company. And I'm grateful for their support during that and during many other times.
So how do you go about really finding those investors that ultimately are going to be there, that they're going to have your back, that are going to be supportive during those times? You know, what have you learned about filtering investors that are going to be there for the right reasons?
Yeah, you know, I think obviously, maybe not obviously, the first conversation I have with an investor is always really revealing. Did they look at the materials I sent ahead of time? Are their questions well-reasoned and are they clear, or are they just the same questions they ask to everybody else? Do they have a perspective on the industry, on our industry, that is consistent with my own? And do they want to build the kind of company I want to build? There are lots of companies and investors that would push us to go, you know, work and make chemical weapons. You know, that's a thing that people do and is a real risk with AI. We will not do that. That is off limits for us in every way. But then the next piece is key. Always do reference checks. I don't hire an employee without doing reference checks. I don't bring on an investor without doing reference checks. And especially for ones that will have some sort of control position in the company, I need to have an understanding of not just what went well. Don't just give me your best portfolio company's CEO. Give me one that you went through some struggles with, because it's really in those moments when things are tough that people show their true colors. And I would say I don't have any investors around my table that I'm unhappy with, but I have a couple in particular that have been both personal and professional supports to me in really big ways. And I know that I can have straightforward conversations with about what's best for the company and best for their investment.
So let's talk about now, you know, continuing in the path of talking about people here. I know that during COVID, there were some bumpy times for you guys. What happened there, and how did you mitigate some of those hurdles?
Yeah, so you know, we were entering a period, you know, we went through this transition that we're talking about to being a software company in 2018 and into 2019. And we were getting a lot of positive signal from the market and thought we were about to grow very quickly. And we hired effectively to that level. We were our largest we've ever been at the end of 2019, early 2020. And of course, I think we all know what the early part of March 2020 looked like. It was an economic disaster. And the chemicals industry really felt it badly, mostly because you can't make chemicals without being together in person. And so a lot of these companies virtually shut down. I mean, they were still operating, but they were not investing in anything. And so we had to cut the team by nearly 50% at that time. It was maybe 40% or so. I don't remember the exact number, but it was a really, really big cut. And we did it quickly. We made a move in April. That was, you know, I think ended up being a thing that was really helpful to us in making it through that time. But it really etched something in my brain. And we've had to do some right sizing a couple times since. And every time it's etched deeper, which is we really, really need to make sure that we only hire the people that we absolutely need on this team. There should be no luxuries until we're incredibly profitable, because, you know, it's nice to have those things, but when the bad day comes, you find your tank out of fuel pretty quickly. So there was an Apple earnings call a couple months ago, maybe it was even just a month ago, the Apple CFO made a comment about having the right number of people. And he said, if you have the right people, you don't need very many of them. And I've come to believe that very strongly. It's a really, really key thing to hire the right team, build the right team, support them with everything you have, but don't bring on an extra 5 people because one person isn't doing so great. Go find the right one person and make sure that they're able to execute for you.
So obviously when we're thinking about investors, people, customers, they're all betting on vision, right? So when we're thinking about the vision here, imagine you were to go to sleep tonight and Greg, you wake up in a world where the vision of the company, you know, of Citroën is fully realized. What does that world look like?
Yeah, it's where materials are a lever of design, a design feature of every product. You know, when Apple releases a new iPhone, they release a new material with it almost every single time. Titanium was last time. They did some other aluminum stuff and magnesium stuff in the past. The key, but they're sort of special at that. And increasingly what we're seeing is materials, you know, the metals we use, the plastics we use, the glasses we use are really sort of need to be custom tailored. We're really pushing things that hard. And so just like you don't design a car just by making the car, you design every part digitally first. We need to design our materials digitally first. And what that means is more sustainable materials, cheaper materials, and more performant materials so that our cars are lighter, they get better mileage, our phones are better, our textiles and clothing are better. Everything is better because it's tailored to its use case and we take less of a toll on the planet.
So we're talking about the future here, but I want to talk about the past and doing so with a lens of reflection. If I was to bring you back in time, and let's say I bring you back in time to that moment that, you know, you guys were at Stanford thinking about, you know, that company that you were going to build. And let's say you're able to show up, you know, right there on the spot and be able to have a conversation with your younger self, with perhaps your co-founder, and being able to provide one piece of advice before launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
I think it would be to say, trust yourself. There have been lots of times where I've had a particular view of where I thought things were going. Even things like technology, where that was not my expertise, right? You know, I have technology background, but I've had technical people on the team that specialize in that all the way along. And there are certainly times where I look back and I say, I knew better than to allow us to make a decision in that way. And I knew where the industry was going. And I ceded control. I put it in somebody else's hands too early. And I think now I found a much better balance. I have debates with my technical team. Even when I'm not going to make the final decision, we push each other in a productive way because I know the industry. I think I was a little too soft at times. That's not to say you can't be soft. I'm not somebody who believes in sort of founders make all decisions. I think that leads to its own set of challenges. But I do think having great people around you and then pushing them harder and harder is a good lesson and one that I think we would have benefited from years ago.
So obviously you've been at it now for 11 years. And obviously you guys have gone through different cycles in the business. How have you gone about to being able to develop yourself as well as the company was growing?
Yeah, you know, I've gone through periods of faster learning and slower learning. I think there have been some really hard periods where I've learned a lot. And that's maybe the periods of most intense learning. But I've gone through phases. There was the technology learning, there was the market learning, and there was the leadership learning. And then finally, probably the strategy learning phase. I work very closely with a couple of advisors and mentors, call them coaches, one in particular that is kind of my go-to guy to talk things out. Because what I've learned is nobody has all the answers, but the people who have the closest thing to the answers are the ones who've done it before. And, you know, so I use this person, his name is Tom. We talk all the time. And I'll say, hey, I've got this HR issue, or I've got this strategy issue, or I've got this question, or I've got this pesky customer, or I've got this other problem. How would you think about it? And he doesn't give me an answer. He starts a conversation. And that's the thing that feels best is not getting to the answer. It's understanding how to think through these problems in the future. And if anything, what I'm most excited about as we take Citrine to the next level, because we are kind of getting through the current phase of our growth, my most exciting thing about that is to learn a new set of things. What happens? How do we go from being the best in our industry to being a profitable company that can really step on the gas from a growth standpoint? And I'm really looking forward to that moment, because it's right around the corner for us, and it's one where new problems that I've never seen before will crop up, and I'll learn from those too.
Absolutely. Well, Greg, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
Email is best. It's just greg@citrine.io. Feel free to reach out. We're doing exciting things in chemistry and materials and artificial intelligence. And so if you're interested in this space, we'd love to hear from you.
Amazing. Well, Greg, well, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
Thank you, Alejandro. It's been a pleasure.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.